Hello everyone, and welcome back to the History of Scotland, episode 12, A Day in a Life of a Pict. Last week we touched upon the kingdoms in and around Scotland, Christianity, the European kingdoms in the mid-10th century, around the 950s AD, around Indulf and then Duff McMalcolm's reign, which we discussed both of those reigns 3 episodes ago, ending, as I've said many times now, and you're probably sick of hearing it, Culain coming to the throne. Now, before we return to our new King of the Albans, new King of Scotland, Culain, in next week's episode, I want us to go through what life was like for your everyday Pict back in the 950s AD, how the structure of the kingdom worked, and how did Scotland perform as a nation compared to the other European kingdoms that we touched upon in last week's episode. As we've already gone through the wars, the kingdoms, the religions at this time, how did this affect just your everyday man or woman? In this episode, we're going to be referencing multiple sources from different chronicles, stories, sagas, referencing modern archaeology. So this is going to seem a little bit disjointed, a little bit all over the place, but I'm going to try and keep it as coherent as possible, just to hopefully give you an idea of how the structure and how a day in the life of your average Pict, Alban, male, female, would be at this time. So if we go through the structure of it, how I'm going to split it up, we're going to be touching upon the warriors. So the hill forts, ships, the actual warriors themselves, kinship, social structure, slavery, religious life, education, demography, the trade, the agriculture, rural housing, the art, and the literature. It's going to be a bit of a big one, but we'll get through it, and this will hopefully set us up nicely for next week's episode when we start getting back into Culain and the family in Scotland at the moment. Obviously, this little rivalry that's going on between Constantine II's descendants and Malcolm I's descendants, and the changing of thrones, and how that will end and affect Scotland in the future. So, if we now start with the warriors of Scotland. In the politically divided world of the Kingdom of Alba, the nucleus of most armed forces was a leader's bodyguard or warband. In Brittonic languages, this was called a tilleru, or the war band of Devrier. In Latin, the most common word in this period is tutorus, and derives from the Latin verb tuar, defend, preserve from danger. In peacetime, the war band's activity was centred around the Great Hall. Here, in both Germanic and Celtic cultures, the feasting, drinking, and other forms of male bonding that kept up the warband's integrity would take place. It is not likely that any warband in the period exceeded 120 to 150 men, as no hall structure having a capacity larger than has been found by archaeologists in Scotland. The warband was the core of the larger armies that were mobilised from time to time for campaigns of significant size. These wider forces depended on the obligations to defend a province or kingdom by land and sea. Early sources from the Kingdom of Del Rita indicate an attempt to define this as an obligation based on landholding, with obligations to provide a specific number of men or ships based on the amount of land held by an individual. Some of the Pictish stones show warriors with swords, spears, bows, helmets, and shields. These imageries may show infantry in formation or gathered together for protection, and they show mounted troops, sometimes heavily armoured, suggesting a mounted warrior elite, as was common in most other areas. If we look to the hill forts, early fortifications in the Kingdom of Alba, particularly in the north and the west, included modest stone-built towers known as brocks and dunns, and particularly in the south and east, larger hill forts. There is evidence for about 1,000 Iron Age hill forts in Scotland, most located below the Clyde Forth line. They appear to have been largely abandoned in the Roman period, but some seem to have been reoccupied after their departure. Most are circular, with a single palisade around the enclosure. Forts of the early medieval era in this time of Scotland's history, however, were often smaller, more compact. The larger number of hill forts in Scotland may have made open battle less important than it was in Anglo-Saxon England, and the relatively high proportion of kings who are recorded as dying in fires suggests that sieges were more important part of warfare in the Kingdom of Albert. Sea power may have been important. The Irish annals record an attack by the Picts on Orkney in 682 AD, which must have necessitated a large naval force. And also, they lost around 150 ships in a disaster in 729. Ships were also vital in the amphibious warfare in the Highlands and islands in and around Scotland. And it indicates that the Del Rita had a ship muster system that obliged groups of households to produce a total of 177 ships and 2,400 men on average. The same source mentions the first recorded naval battle around the British Isles in 719 AD and 8 naval expeditions between the 560s and the 730s AD. The only vessels to survive from this period are dugout canoes, but images from the period suggest that there may have been skin boats, similar to the Irish curragh, and larger oared vessels. The Viking raids and invasions of British Isles, however, were based on a superior sea power, which enabled the creation of sea-based longships of the north and west. The longship, the key to the Viking success as we all know, was a graceful, long, narrow, light wooden boat with a shallow draft hull designed for speed. This shallow draft allowed navigation in waters only 3 feet deep and permitted beach landings, while its lightweight enabled it to be carried over rivers and land. Longships were also double-ended, the symmetrical bow and stern allowing the ship to reverse direction quickly without having to turn around. And that's the basics of the military around this time, if you're a part of the warrior elite. Kingship was a primary unit of social organisation in most Germanic and Celtic European kingdoms in the early Middle Ages. And this was a king group in the case around the 950s AD in the Kingdom of Albert. The mention of descent through the female line in the ruling families of the Picts in later sources and the recurrence of leaders clearly from the outside of Pictish society has led to the conclusion that their system of descent was matrilineal. However, this has been challenged by a number of historians who argue that the clear evidence of awareness of descent through the male line suggests that this was more likely to indicate an agnatic system of descent, typical of Celtic societies and common throughout North Britain. And through this social structure, the scattered evidence, including the records in the Irish annals and the visual images like the warriors depicted in the Pictish stones, they suggest in upper ranks of society formed of the military aristocracy, whose status was largely dependent on their ability and willingness to fight. And we've seen that with some of the kings that we've touched on so far in the Kingdom of Albert. And we'll continue to see that pretty much up until the King Robert de Bruce, where things start to change a little bit differently. Below the level of autocracy, it is assumed that there were non-noble freemen, working their own small farms or holding them as free tenants. There are no surviving law codes from Scotland, sadly, in this period, but as it was in Anglo-Saxon England, we can kind of base some of that upon how the Anglo-Saxons structured it, but also such codes in Ireland and Wales indicate that freemen had the right to bear arms, represent themselves in law, and to receive compensation for murdered kinsmen. Slavery was a lot different, and obviously as a slave we all know your rights were significantly less. What's cool about slavery in terms of the information in history, other than it being obviously a terrible part of history, is the depiction in Roman society. Slaves became in Roman society a lot, they had a lot more rights and they had a pretty easy path to becoming free. Unfortunately, throughout the Dark Ages and also the early Middle Ages, that kind of reverses and slaves' lives are a lot more brutal, they have less rights, and the path to becoming a freeman is a lot harder. Indications are that the society in North Britain, for example, contained a relatively large number of slaves, often taken in war and raids, or brought as St. Patrick indicated the Picts were doing from the Britons in southern Scotland. Slave owning probably reached relatively far down in society, with most rural households containing some slaves. Because they were taken relatively young, many slaves would have been more integrated into their societies of capture than the societies of origin in terms of both culture and language. Living and working beside their owners in practice, they may have become members of a household without the inconvenience of the portable inheritance rights that divided estates. Where there is better evidence from England and elsewhere, it was common for slaves who survived to middle age to gain their freedom, with such freedmen often remaining clients of their families or of their former masters. Religious life was different in Cullen's time. When he came to the throne, most evidence of religious practice came from monks and is heavily based towards the monasticistic life. From this, we can see the daily cycle of prayers and the celebration of Mass. There was also the business of farming, fishing, and in the islands, seal hunting. Literary life revolved around the completion of texts and the copying of manuscripts. Libraries were of great importance to the monastic communities. The one at Iona, for example, may have been exceptional, but it demonstrates that the monks were a part of the mainstream of European Christianity culture. Less well recorded, but as significant, was the roles of the bishops and their clergy. Bishops dealt with the leaders of the Tuath and ordained the clergy and consecrated churches. They also had responsibilities for the poor, hungry, prisoners, widows and orphans. Priests carried out baptisms, masses and burials. They also prayed for the dead and offered sermons. They anointed the sick with oil, brought commune to the dying and administered penance to sinners. Early local churches were widespread, but since they were largely made of wood, like the excavated one at Whitehorn, the only evidence that survives for the most is in place that names contains words for church, including Sill, Both, Etel and Ett, but others are indicated by stone crosses and Christian burials. Beginning on the west coast and islands and spreading south and east, these were replaced with basic masonry-built buildings that we are familiar with in today's history looking back. Education was different in and around the 950s in the Kingdom of Albert and was overwhelmingly an oral society, and education was verbal rather than literary. Fuller sources for Ireland of the same period suggest that there were many people who acted as poets, musicians and historians, often attached to the court of a lord or a king, and passed on their knowledge in Gaelic to the next generation. After the de-Gaelicization of the Scottish court from the 12th century, a less highly recorded order of bards took over these functions, and they would continue to act in a similar role in the Highlands and the Islands into the 18th century. They often trained in bardic schools, of which a few, like the one run by the Mecmuc dynasty, who were the bards to the Lord of the Isles, existed in Scotland and a larger number in Ireland until they were suppressed from the 17th century. Much of their work was never written down, and what survives was only recorded from the 16th century. The establishment of Christianity brought Latin to Scotland as a scholarly and written language. Monasteries served as a major place for knowledge and education, often running schools and providing a small educated elite with the essential to create and read documents in a largely illiterate society. If we look at the demography of Scotland, there were almost no written sources to go off to reconstruct what the 950s were like. Estimates may have been from 10,000 inhabitants in Delrita and 80 to 100,000 in Pictland. It is likely that the 5th and 6th centuries saw higher mortality rates due to the appearance of the bubonic plague, which may have reduced the net population. The known conditions have been taken to suggest it was a highly fertile society, but also a high mortality society as well. Similar to many developing countries in the modern world, with a relatively young demographic profile and perhaps early childbearing and large numbers of children for women. This would have meant there were a relatively small proportion of available workers to the numbers of mouths to feed. This would have made it difficult to produce a surplus that would allow the demographic to grow and become more complex for societies to develop. Scottish trade, on the other hand, was entirely different. There are not that many detailed custom accounts for the most of the period that exist for Scotland that can provide an understanding of foreign trade, with the first records of England dating back to the 1320s and also in Scotland. Anecdotal and archaeological historical evidence gives some indication of the nature of trade for the early Middle Ages. The rise of Christianity meant that wine and precious materials were imported for use in religious rites, and there are occasional references to journeys to and from foreign countries, such as the incident recorded by a bowman in St. Columbia, who went to a port to await ships bearing news and presumably other items from Italy. Imported goods found in archaeological sites of the period include many glass items, iron, precious metalworking. The slave trade was also as important, as we touched upon, with most rural households containing some slaves. Kings are often mentioned raiding for slaves, as we know with the Vikings in particular. A letter of St. Patrick indicates that the Picts were buying slaves from the Britons in what is now southern Scotland. So the Kingdom of Bernicia is one of them. The slave trade in the Irish Sea may have been stimulated by the arrival of the Vikings from the late 8th century and would continue to dominate for the next century. Agriculture in the Kingdom of Alba was a lot different. Scotland is roughly half the size of England and Wales if you have a map, and has approximately the same amount of coastline, but only between a fifth and a sixth of the amount of the arable or good pastoral land under 60 metres above sea level, and most of this is located in the south and east. This made marginal pastoral farming and fishing the key factors in the pre-modern economy. Its East Atlantic position meant that it had a moderate rainfall. Today, about 700 millilitres per year in the east and over 1,000 millilitres in the west. This encouraged the spread of the blanket peat bog, the acidity of which, combined with a high level of wind and salt spray, made most of the western islands treeless. The existence of hills, mountains, quicksands and marshes made agriculture and internal communication difficult, but it also provided a heavily place to be guarded and stay safe from invasions. As we know in Scottish history, the Scots would hide in the Highlands, similar to how the Welsh hid in their mountains around Snowdonia. The relative importance of climate and human interference has been debated, but Scotland was certainly much more heavily forested before humans arrived. The early Middle Ages, from the 5th century to the 10th century, were a period of climate deterioration, with a drop in temperature and an increase in rainfall, resulting in more land becoming unproductive. With a lack of significant transport links and wider markets, most farms had to produce a self-sufficient diet of meat, dairy products, cereals, supplemented by hunter-gathering. Limited evidence indicates that farming was based around a single homestead or a small cluster of three or four homes, each probably containing a nuclear family, with kinship relationships likely to be common among neighbouring houses and settlements, reflecting the partition of land through inheritance. The climate meant that more oats and barley were grown than wheat. The evidence of bones indicate that cattle were by far the most important domesticated animal, as we mentioned, but this was also followed by pigs, sheep and goats, while domesticated fowl were very rare. Christian monasteries from Ireland may have changed our agriculture practice, bringing innovations such as the watermill, mouldboard, ploughs, and they were much more effective in turning the soil. If we look to how the rural housing was, there were very few rural houses surviving in the area around medieval Scotland. As in England, crook construction was used, employing pairs of curved timbers to support a roof. However, unlike in England, they were usually hidden from view. The major timbers often belonged to a local laird and were known as master woods or master timbers, and were often reused. The responsibility for infilling the walls usually belonged to the tenants. There were extensive use of turf to fill in the walls, sometimes on a stone base, but they were not long-lasting and had to be rebuilt perhaps as often as every 2 or 3 years. In some regions, including the southwest and around Dundee, solid clay walls were used, or a combination of clay, turf and straw rendered with clay or lime to make them weatherproof. With a lack of long-span structural timber, the most common building material was stone, employed in both mortared and dry stone construction. Different regions used broom, heather, straw, turfs or reeds for roofing. Central to most houses was the hearth. The simplest were in the centre of the floor, with smoke exiting through a hole in the roof, and this form tended to be used longer in the Highlands. More developed forms had a backstone of a single flagstone or walling. There is no evidence of lowland houses with canopies for smoke extraction in the lowland areas, with simple windows being used instead. Art in the Kingdom of Alba was a lot different. About 250 Pictish stones survive and have been assigned by scholars to three classes. Class 1 stones are thought to date to the period up to the 7th century and are the most numerous group. The stones are largely unshaped and include incised symbols of animals such as fish and the Pictish beast, everyday objects such as mirrors, combs and tuna forks, and abstract symbols defined by the names including V-rod, double disc and Z-rod. They are found between from the 5th or the 4th to Shetland. The greatest concentrations are in Sutherland, around modern Inverness and Aberdeen. Good examples include Dunrobin in Sutherland and Alberono in Angus. Class 2 stones are carefully shaped slabs dating after the arrival of Christianity in the 8th and 9th centuries, with a cross on one face and a wide range of symbols on the reverse. In similar numbers, the Class 1 stones, they were predominantly in southern Pictland, in Perth, Angus and the Fife. Good examples include Glamis II, which contains a finely executed Celtic cross on the main face with two opposing male figures, a centaur, a cauldron, deer head and a triple disc symbol and a consus. Class 3 stones are thought to overlap chronologically with the Class 2 stones. Most are elaborately shaped and incised crone slabs with some figurative scenes but lacking Pictish symbols. These are widely distributed but predominant in the southern Pictish areas. Pictish metalwork was a little bit different. Items of metalwork have been found throughout Pictland. These earlier picks appear to have had a considerable amount of silver available, probably from raiding further south or the payment of subsidies to keep them from doing so. The very large hoard of late Roman hack silver found at Trepanlaw may have originated in either way. The largest hoard of early Pictish metalwork was found in 819 at Norrie's Law in Fife, but unfortunately much was dispersed and melted down. Over 10 heavy silver chains, some over 0.5 metres long, have been found from this period. The double-linked white clutch chain is one of the only two to have a pendular ring, with symbol decoration including an amulet, which shows how they were probably used as a choker necklace. The St. Ninian's Isle treasure of 28 silver and silver gilt objects contains perhaps the best collection of late Pictish forms from the Christian period, when Pictish metal style and stone carving gradually merged with insular Anglo-Saxon and Viking styles. Viking age art avoided naturalism, favouring stylized animal motifs to create its ornamental patterns. Ribbon interface was important and plant motifs became fashionable in the 10th and 11th century. Most Scottish artifacts come from the 130 pagan burials in the north and west from the mid-9th to the mid-10th century. These include jewellery, weapons, occasional elaborate high statue items. Among the most impressive of these items is a scarboat burial on Orkney, which contained an elaborate sword, quiver with arrows, a brooch, bone comb, gaming pieces and a scar dragon plaque made from whalebone, which was probably made in Scandinavia. Literature, on the other hand, in the Kingdom of Alba was very, very low. After the collapse of the Roman authority in the early 5th century, four major circles of political and cultural influence emerged in northern Britain. In the east, as we know, there were the Picts, whose kingdoms eventually stretched from the River Forth to Shetland. Modern scholarship based on the surviving place names and historical evidence indicates that the Pictish language was Brythonic British. In the west were the Gaelic people of Del Rita, who had close links with Ireland from who they brought with them the name Scots. In the south were the British or the Brythonic people, descendants of the peoples of the Roman influenced kingdoms of the Old North. The most powerful and longest surviving of this, as we touched upon last week, was the kingdom of Strathclyde. Finally, they were the English or the Angles, Germanic invaders who had overrun much of southern Britain and held the kingdom of Bernicia, later became part of the kingdom of Northumbria, which reached into what are now the borders of Scotland in the southeast. To these languages, Christianization, particularly from the 6th century, added Latin as an intellectual and written language. No written literature for the Picts has survived into the modern era. However, there is literature from what would become Scotland, Brythonic, Gaelic, Old English, and Latin. Much of the earliest Welsh culture was actually composed in or near country now called Scotland, in Brythonic speech, from which the Welsh would be derived. At this time, it was not then confined to Wales and Cornwall. These works were only written down in Wales much later. These include the Gododdin, considered the early surviving verse from Scotland, which is attributed to the bard Aneurin, said to have been a resident in the Brythonic kingdom of Gododdin in the 6th century. In Old English, there is a dream of the rood, which lines are found in the Ruthwell Cross, making it the only surviving fragment of the Northumbrian Old English from early medieval Scotland. It's also been suggested on the basis of references that the poem, The Seafarer, was composed somewhere near the base rock in East Lothian. Early works in Latin include a prayer for protection attributed to St. Mudgent, thought to be from the mid-6th century, and another one attributed to St. Columbia. What is probable is the most important work written in early medieval Scotland was around 627 AD. The most important piece of Scottish verses was written in Latin in Whithorn, perhaps as early as the 8th century, and that was about the life of Nudan. So ends our day in the life in the Pict, giving you guys hopefully an understanding of the structure for Scotland at this time. This also ends our special episodes about life in general and kingdoms in the 950s AD. Hopefully this is giving you a better understanding on the grander politics, structure and day-to-day life in Scotland at this period of time in the 9th century, just as these kingdoms, including the Kingdom of Alba, were becoming more recognised on a European scale. Like I said last week, we will try and do one of these around the 12th, 13th century to give you an update on how things have changed since then. But due to me compacting so much information into these three podcasts, which honestly could have lasted about 50 podcasts and different types of stories, please let me know of any corrections or issues at thehistoryofscotlandpodcast@gmail.com. Next week, we finally return to our story and carry on with our new King of Alba, Cúchulainn, and the family of internal wars between Constantine II, Indulf's side, and Malcolm I's side, which will end in the entire family falling apart and the House of Dunkeld rising to take its place. Please, as always, leave a review if you can on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean, Amazon Music, and Google Podcasts. As always, our shows are always available weekly on those platforms. Other than that, all is to say is look out for next week's episode around Friday, Saturday. Have a great week. Stay safe. Hope you're all doing well. And I will catch you all on the next one. Peace.